200 days into Israel's genocide in Gaza, more Palestinians fall victim to the relentless attacks, with the death toll passing 34,180. Hamas says the U.S. is a full partner in Israel's genocide in Gaza by providing cover for the regime's crimes. And U.S. police arrest dozens of pro-Palestine students as protests against the Gaza genocide gain momentum on American university campuses. Thanks for joining us. It's day 200 of the Israeli genocide in Gaza. The regime continues its massacre of civilians by pounding the blockaded territory with more airstrikes and artillery fire. In the latest attacks, at least one Palestinian was killed and several injured as Israeli warplanes targeted a house in the Nuseirat refugee camp in central Gaza. The Israeli artillery also struck an area in the Al Zaytun neighborhood south of Gaza City, causing a large fire. The Palestinian Health Ministry says 32 Palestinians were killed and 59 others injured in the past 24 hours. That brings the overall death toll to more than 34,180 since October 7. More than 77,000 people have also been injured. The Geneva-based human rights organization has warned that the people of Gaza face an increased risk of infections and epidemics due to the collapse of the health system. Earlier, correspondent Muti Abu Musaba joined us from the central Gaza city of Deir al-Balah to update us on the situation in the war-ravaged, besieged Palestinian Strip.
This genocidal war against Gaza Strip enters its 200th consecutive day with more destruction, more attacks, and more bloodshed of the Palestinian civilians. Over the last night, the Israeli occupation forces actually intensified and concentrated their attacks and airstrikes against all areas of Gaza Strip. And these attacks are still maintained so far. As we speak right now, we can hear the bombardments and the explosions are booming these moments in the eastern part of the central area of Gaza Strip, basically Al-Maghazi refugee camp and Al-Burij refugee camp. Those areas were under heavy bombardments and attacks of the Israeli artillery shelling. In addition to that, and the northern part of Al-Nusrat refugee camp was also hit relentlessly over the last night with more relentless Israeli strikes and artillery shelling. The central area of Gaza Strip has been under heavy bombardments for at least 2 consecutive weeks so far. And according to, as you know, the Israeli occupation forces are threatening to conduct more operations and more attacks against the central area of Gaza Strip. Dozens of the Palestinian residential buildings were completely targeted and destroyed by the Israeli warplanes using the ceaseless Israeli strikes and the artillery shelling that was concentrated and maintained against the northern part of Al-Nusrat refugee camp and the eastern part of Al-Burij refugee camp.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Hamas says that Israel does not hesitate to commit the most heinous atrocities against civilians in Gaza, with the U.S. administration providing it criminal cover. In a statement, the Palestinian resistance movement said that the U.S. is a full partner in the Israeli genocide in the besieged Strip. Hamas added that the discovery of a mass grave in the Nasser hospital complex in the city of Khan Yunis confirms that Palestinians are facing a fascist enemy thirsty for murder and blood. Civil service workers in Gaza have recovered the bodies of 310 Palestinians in Nasser Hospital's courtyard, most of them women and children and the elderly. The mass grave was created when Israeli forces were besieging the facility last month. Some of those executed were blindfolded and handcuffed. Mick Napier, co-founder of the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, joins us from Edinburgh. We also have Julia Kassam, journalist and political analyst, who joins us from Beirut. Welcome to you both. So, Mick Napier, the unfortunate, milestone of another, I should say, milestone is this 200th day that we're looking at, today being that day. We are looking at the discovery of this mass grave, which Hamas has slammed, I believe, roughly about 300-plus bodies. When you take a look at the previous mass graves and the previous massacres that have happened at the hospitals, why? What is it that... is Israel looking for that it continues to commit these atrocities at the hospitals when it's not finding its intended goal, whatever it may think it's looking for?
Well, the intended goal from the very beginning was to drive Palestinians out of Gaza, as they have been driving Palestinians out of Palestine for a very long time. And this can only be accomplished by the massive application of violence. So the so-called war against Hamas was always, from the very beginning, and any objective observer would conclude this, was to terrorize the Palestinians out of Gaza. The latest developments are, beyond words. Hands tied behind their back, mainly women and children, hundreds and hundreds of bodies. It doesn't reduce the horror of that to say that Israel has actually been doing this for a very, very long time. Palestinian history is punctuated by such massacres, from 1948 onwards. So, but this one is special in that the whole world is watching, and is watching using technology that didn't exist before. So this is genocide. If it's not genocide, then it's difficult to imagine what the international law specifies as genocide. And it's going to be impossible for the ICJ not to conclude that Israel's committing genocide. So what are we looking at? We're looking at the possibility of cholera, typhus, various epidemics, continuing the grisly work of the Israeli military. And it's also a long tradition of Western genocides in Central America, in South Asia, in Palestine as well. By the way, for a historical footnote, it was the Zionists who introduced bacteriological warfare into the Middle East. And they were caught doing it by the British, who then hanged a couple of them for putting typhus and various other germs into the water supply. So Israel has no compunction about wiping out large numbers of Palestinians using germ warfare, and that seems to be what's happening at the moment. It's beyond words. It's a long, long, long tradition, but this is a particularly horrifying example of it. To find these scores and scores of bodies, comparisons, by the way, for Europeans with the Nazis are absolutely natural. This is the kind of thing which happened across Europe under Nazi rule. They didn't have a monopoly of it, but we're currently bound by regime. We're not bound, defying them for the bonds, but our regime, our governments are trying to prevent any comparison by people, by citizens, of Israel's behaviour with that of the Nazis in World War II. But that comparison is becoming absolutely undeniable, and this today could be transposed to many massacres committed against people, Jews, of course, and many other people in Europe, because they were the wrong kind of people. So Israel is carrying on that grisly, the most horrific parts of the human tradition, and it's doing it in the full light of day. And you can't avoid the conclusion that they want the world to see this. They want the world to think that the Israelis are capable of any atrocity, and therefore don't defy them.
We need to talk, Julia Qassam, of the U.S. role here, because Hamas has also pointed that out. And it's interesting that you have the U.S. again coming out. Just a couple of days back, I believe, was the Human Rights Report, of which we understand that obviously it did not come out and say anything against Israel, although there are rumors that it may actually sanction maybe at least one of the army units. But that itself is ironic, given the fact that it's providing the tools for Israel to commit the genocide. What is your view of the U.S. Cooperation when it comes to the massacres taking place?
The U.S. is the prime funder and prime backer of this genocide in Gaza. Every single genocide before it, whether ideologically, historically, or in recent years, in the last 5 years, materially. So what we see right now in Gaza is continuously escalating, continuously unprecedented, both in its reach and its atrocities, genocide against the Palestinian people, completely enabled and abetted by the U.S., which not only continues to in weapons to the defiant entity. But even fast tracks and bypasses its own congressional approval, it has done 3 times, in order to continue to funnel the same weapons that are causing the massacre and slaughter of over 30,000 Palestinians. Time and time again, the U.S. has turned a blind eye, whether at the UN Security Council or any other international body assembled in with the intention of, you know, holding accountable crimes against humanity, that we're seeing today. The U.S. uses its disproportionate institutional influence on so-called international communities, institutions, to strike down for any attempt at gaining accountability, whether in the ICJ or in the UN Security Council. The U.S. has constantly provided cover, in addition to weapons, which it is the prime supporter of the Israeli genocide that we're seeing today. Over 69% of weapons start using to slaughter the Gazans come from the U.S. and about 30% from Germany. And it continues again to do so without impunity, without any reservations. And the lives of Palestinians, the lives of innocent Palestinians, are, you know, basically sacrificed and disposable for the sake of preserving the Zionist entity, even after it has, reached, Vienna Convention began, it struck diplomatic territory. The U.S. Had reservations about the invasion of Rafah that the Zionist entity is undergoing its last step in salvaging its losing invasion. And, you know, for months the U.S. has said that it had reservations against this because of the tactical disadvantages that it would bring upon the entire U.S.-backed Israeli incursion into Gaza. But of course, when the U.S. wanted to protect the Zionist entity from further escalation in a potential Iranian retaliation to their retaliation, they immediately greenlit the continuation of the genocide that we're seeing today as it reached Rafah. So after we uncovered, after the uncovering of the massacre in Khan Yunis, where the Zionist entity was beaten 3 weeks ago by the Palestinian resistance, and now after withdrawal, we're seeing the ghastly way that it's been picking it out on civilians, medical workers included, children included, women included. The Zionist entity is going to meet the same fate in Rafah, which is a total defeat, essentially. And this would conclude the entire failure of a ground invasion in Gaza that produced nothing but civilian genocide. Unfortunately, and this is the case as you can see in the days after, the last few days, especially in the aftermath of the Zionist symbolic strike on Iran with the toy quad copters, basically. They commenced their further aggression on Rafah, and which has produced nothing but civilian and child casualties, despite the whole intention of this invasion being to cut off what they perceive as being the last line of the resistance, their last effort to save face and salvage everything that they've lost in this humiliating invasion, right. And to commence the displacement of Palestinians, which is the ultimate goal that they think that they can achieve in light of these losses, into Rafah, which the preparations are being handled also by the regime and by the UAE and West.
All right, let me thank our guests. We're fresh out of time. Mick Napier, co-founder of Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign. Julie Kassam, their journalist and political analyst. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Pro-Palestinian sentiments reach fever pitch among American university students as protests against the Gaza genocide are now in full swing on campuses. Protests at Columbia University have forced authorities to cancel in-person classes. Elsewhere in the Northeast, dozens of protesters were arrested at Yale University. Massachusetts, gates to Harvard Yard were closed to the public in an attempt to head off protests. Students have also set up tents and held rallies and sit-ins at other U.S. campuses across the country. They demand that universities divest finances from manufacturers that sell weapons to Israel. And that is it for World News. Thanks so much for being with us. That's bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Conversation. Hello, I'm Jim Gibney, and welcome to a special edition of The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs around Ireland. This week, we take a look at the 1981 hunger strike. Much has been written about this tumultuous period in our history. But one area which has not received much attention is the communication system used by both the leadership of Sinn Féin on the outside and the prisoners on the inside. So let's introduce today's guests. Joining me today is Tom Hartley, who is in charge of the POW department and organised the communication system from the outside. I'm also joined today by former political prisoner Sheena Walsh, who can speak authoritatively about the communication from inside the H blocks during the hunger strike of 1981. And firstly then, over to Tom. So Tom, first of all, why was there a communication system needed and when did you put it together? When did you organise it?
Well, of course, the prison authorities done all in their power to close down the communications between the prisoners and the outside. And that meant, of course, that there wasn't a flow and it was often difficult to get information in and out of the jail. And, of course, men were and women in the Armagh, they were locked away, they were on strike, they were on the no-wash, and all of that, these conditions made it difficult to have a flow of information in and out of the jail, or indeed all of it made it difficult to have a flow of communications. So I was appointed head of the POW department sometime, I think about, was 1979, 1980. And of course, the context for all of this is a very deepening crisis in the Hayes Blocks and Armagh Women's Prison. And so I was appointed as the chair of the POW department, and the first thing I set myself to do was to create a communications between us outside and the prisoners inside, because it was obvious that we needed a flow of information, because the period we were going through was, it was a deep political crisis.
When you say a crisis, what exactly do you mean in terms of how many prisoners were you dealing with on the inside in the Hayes Blocks and in Armagh Women's Prison?
Well, I think by that time there was a few hundred. Remember, there was always an increasing number of prisoners, and it was never a static number. And so you had the prisoners in the Hayes Blocks and the women in Armagh Jail. But what was really going on was this big, crisis inside the jails. It was really imperative that the leadership outside had an understanding of the conditions inside, what the Republican prisoners were enduring, what was happening to them, and what was happening to them on a daily basis. So I went then to see Maura McCrory, and Maura was in charge of the Relatives Action Committee. And so I explained to Maura what was required in terms of communication. Now, Maura then went to the Relatives Action Committee, and the Relatives Action Committee was made up of the girlfriends, mothers, sisters, grandmothers of the prisoners. And so Maura then brought me back a list of those who were going in to visit. So that was really the start of a process where we could determine who was going to what block, who was going to Armagh, and then we started to build this communication network with the prisoners. And in time, of course, the prisoners then sent us what visits they were taking. So, in fact, there was a coordinated approach between ourselves and the prisoners to create this flow of information and flow of comms in and out of the jails.
That might be a good point to bring Shana in to explain from the inside, the prison point of view, why it was important that there was this flow of information from inside to outside.
I would have to actually go back a wee bit, because whenever the protest started in September 76 with Kieran Nugent, the vast majority of the prisoners who ended up in the protest refused to take visits because it meant that you would have to wear a prison uniform. So what that then meant was that people didn't know what was happening outside because our letters were being censored, heavily censored, and any information that we could get out usually was word of mouth through the priests who were coming in. Or when we shared it across, you met people from, if you had to go to a hospital or you had to go on appeals or, to go back to court, things like that. That is the only time that you would actually come across other prisoners and be able to get the word out. So it was late 77, early 78, when Brenton Hughes and the team came down from the cages, having lost their status as a result of an incident that happened, a bit of a row with the prison warders in the cages. And they landed down into the blocks. And one of the first things that the dark made clear to people was that people outside didn't know what was going on inside the prisons. They didn't know about the brutality and the deprivation that we were enduring. And so he also initiated a discussion and a debate about the future of the protest. And that actually started then on March 1978. What actually happened was when we took the decision to take visits, it meant that you were coming into more and more contact with the prison warders. And the prison warders resented the fact that we were taking visits, and they stepped up the harassment and the brutality, which then led in turn to us beginning to escalate the protests within the jail, which in turn led to further a further escalation of the brutality, and we ended up on the No Wash protest. We used to take visits with a simple objective of getting the word out of what was happening within the prisons. It was only later then that we decided that we were going to have to organise it in some better fashion, because initially it was very haphazard. You took visits whenever you wanted to take them or whenever it suited your family. We decided that we would have to start taking a more strategic approach to it, because we needed to spread the visits out, whereby we were trying to cover every single day that there would be visits out from every wing and visits, you know, making contact with not only the our visitors, but also making contact with prisoners from the other blocks.
So there's an awareness on the inside that there has to be a much more coordinated approach to get the information outside to Tom and to the party leadership. And then, so Tom, what then happens with this system? You've got a group of women who are basically organised around yourself. What then begins to take shape in terms of the structure? Well, of the communication
system. First of all, it's a very simple system, you know. There's nothing extraordinary about it other than there were visits, and then the prisoners were sending out their information and we were sending in information. So once that was established, that really took off and just worked on its own. And that was a pattern, you know, right through the hunger strikes and right beyond the hunger strikes, that this communication trail was established and then worked. But from early on, certainly when I started to communicate with the prisoners, one of the first things I did was to send in a note, quite a lengthy note, to say, look, you need then to start to write to the Archbishop of Canterbury, the Pope, the Taoiseach, your GAA clubs, your youth clubs, your women's movement, any social connection that was in existence needed to get a note or a letter from a H-block prisoner or a woman in Armagh. And in essence, what then happened was, so prisoners, of course, were on the inside, you might say, you know, really at the coal face of the struggle. But then the role as communicating their conditions to the outside world really externalized the role, you know, so it wasn't that this was an internalized role of prisoners by and large watching what was happening to their comrades in hunger strike. I think suddenly prisoners had this very structured view of what they needed to do to inform the world. You know that old Republican saying, it's no use doing it if you don't tell the world. So the prisoners told the world by the sending out their comms.
So Shana, in terms of inside the prison, who was coordinating that huge effort that Tom is describing?
Well, it would actually have to go back before the hunger strikes again, and in the sense that late 79, there was a push on by the prisoners for a hunger strike. It was actually at the time of the Pope visiting Ireland. In October 79, the Pope came. But before that, there had been the intention to launch a hunger strike. And what then happened was that after some very forthright discussion with the leadership on the outside, the prisoners, they agreed to defer the protest, the hunger strike, and to engage in a whole propaganda campaign, basically, of information, as relayed by Tom there, that we then began to write to everybody that we could think of. Trade unions, GAA groups, credit union organisations, community groups, anybody who we thought would give us an ear. We also wrote to all sorts of politicians, both foreign and domestic. We wrote to any sort of big personalities. Like I remember Bobby Sands talking about writing to Jane Fonda And Jane Fonda actually made some comment in one of the Sunday papers about receiving this calm from the prisons in Ireland and in Lonkesh. So we really sort of got stuck into that from about 1979, late 1979.
In terms of then, because obviously I think Shana was saying that there was phases to this. You know, there's this what he called the propaganda phase leading up to the hunger strike. And at that stage, the flow of information from your end into the prison was routine and in a way casual. But as the situation deteriorates in the prison, you then have the hunger strike of 1980 looming. What then happens to the system, the communication system?
Well, let me explain then how the communications were handled outside. First of all, we would send a communication in at 9:30 in the morning, and were able to get an answer out by 12:30. And then we were able to send another communication in at about 2:00 and get a reply now by, 4:00 or 4:30. And that was fairly standard, you know, that once that was established, that was the pattern, you know, that so we had very good communications. And then as we developed and as the crisis developed, there was small crystal radios sent in. Now, they were so small, but the benefit of the crystal radio was that the blocks were beside the BBC mast at Blair's, so they could pick up the news. So right. That was a help to them. So they were able to hear what was taking place, say, at the 11 o'clock news at night. And that was also an aid. Then we decided that we would miniaturise the Infoblock. And they were about that size. And they were sent in. So there was an intense level of communication going in. Now, what would happen? There was, at one level, there was thousands of communications coming out, and we could not handle all the communications. So generally, we handled the communications to the leadership of Sinn Féin coming out, and we had a room in 51 Falls Road. And so as the communications came out, they would all be sorted, and then we had a team that would write out and then type out on small brown sheets of paper what was in the comm. And these would be presented to the leadership.
You know, one of the things that I always think about is the quote from Pat Sheehan. Pat Sheehan was on the hunger strike for 55 days. He was the longest prisoner on the hunger strike whenever the hunger strike was ended on the 3rd of October in 1981. And Pat talks about whenever he put his name down to go on the hunger strike, that he received a call from the IRA, from the Army Council of the IRA. And what it stated on the call, on the cover of the call, the address of the call, it said on it, Oglach, Pat Sheehan. And Pat was saying that, you know, the only time you ever see a reference to Oglach, anybody, is on a gravestone.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that this had a very profound effect upon him when he received this call from the council.
And do you recall the crystal radios coming into the prison? Was there one in your wing?
The crystal radios, the introduction of the crystal radios was massive in the blocks, because up until then the news that we got was through the visits the sort of weekly news that you would have got from the Republican News whenever we were able to smuggle in. And the crystal sets really changed all that, in that you were able to get an a daily news every night. Now, as we get further into the hunger strike, and particularly as the situation became more and more intense, guys used to listen to the radios during the day. So you have cases where, and it was very dangerous to do that, in the sense that the prison warders could come and open your door at any time. But we were so hungry for news, so eager to keep on top of what was happening to our comrades in the hospitals, listening to any news of the various initiatives that we were getting. Thomas talked about the external groups who were coming up with ways of how to solve the hunger strike in terms of the Irish Commission for Justice and Peace. There was a delegation of southern MEPs come in. There were people come in from the Swiss Red Cross guys come in and visited us at one stage with, looking at different ways to resolve it. There was a constant flow of bishops and, the Pope actually sent an emissary across to try and resolve the hunger strike. So all of this was happening, and it was very important that we were able to listen to any of the developments as they were happening, not only what they were saying when they came into the jail, but what they were saying when they left the jail.
And what was the background to the crystal sets, do you remember?
So an old comrade of mine, Shawnee McVeigh, who RIP, who we both knew, Jim, he came up with the idea of, can we get some sort of a radio in the jail? Surely there's some sort of a radio with miniaturized batteries that you could get in and you could listen to the news and keep abreast of how things are going. And he mentioned this to a good friend of ours, Arthur Fagan. And Arthur, while he didn't have the wherewithal to produce this radio, he knew a guy who did. And he approached this guy and he spoke to him, and they came up with this crystal set. And the beauty of the crystal set was that it didn't need batteries. It worked, and I still don't know how it worked, but it worked by connecting one wire to the grill on the window, and the second wire was connected to the hot water pipes, the heating pipes in the cell, and there was an earpiece which fitted into your ear, and through that, as Tom said, you were able to pick up a signal from Glarus BBC mast.
And did the communication system itself, did it make an intolerable situation on the inside easier to manage? The knowledge that people knew on the outside what was happening to you before the hunger strike began?
Well, it meant that what we were enduring was made known to people outside in general. Mm-hmm. The idea of suffering in silence may well be, something to be admired, but mm-hmm. It wasn't what the protest was about. And I think it was Tom said earlier on that there's an Irish saying that there's no sense in doing something if you don't tell the world about it.
And remember, Jim, if you're not seen, you're not heard. And the cobs were the manifestation of prisoners being seen.
And just finally then on the importance of the comms. And I think in this book, 10 Men Dead, by David Beresford, yeah, the book is based on the comms that survive on the outside, and the story about the hunger strike, hunger strikes in Armagh Women's Prison, hunger strike, both hunger strikes in the Hates Blocks, and the deaths of the 10 lads are reflected in this book. So you can see the importance of them in that regard. But I was just wondering, just what happened to the comms, the ones that survived? Where are they today?
The bulk of them are in the National Library in Dublin.
Yes, and they will be available to be seen at some point?
Yes, but they're being, I think, digitised at the minute because right. They're in a very vulnerable state because they're very flimsy, but they'd be in a very... But they tell their own story of you know, the, what was going on. But they also, when you read them, tell the story of the attitude of prisoners, of their morale, you know, of their sense of themselves as a group. There's so many dimensions of the H-Block and Armagh story that are contained in those columns.
And I suppose when reading the columns, and then when you read Beresford's book and the columns, you see the intensity and also the bravery and heroism of the prisoners in the H-Blocks and Armagh Women's Prison and the most difficult circumstances and what they're experiencing.
And oddly, one of the things you comes across very strong is the humanity of the prisoners, because the humour that is contained in those columns, you know, and it's could be often described as black humour,
yeah,
but it's truly amazing, you know, and it's not of a defeated group, anything, but it's people with ideas, people with a vision, you know, it's they have a sense of their purpose, and it all comes through in the columns.
And the columns recorded that period, that historic period in our history.
Well, the columns did indeed record that whole period from start to finish and even beyond. But one of the things you have to realise too is that all of the columns did not survive in the way that Tom's talking about there in the National Museum. There are people who have dozens of columns themselves,
yeah,
in their own homes. I remember being at an event in South Armagh a couple of years ago with Jim McCann was doing a book launch, the time that Jazz McCann wrote the book about his experiences in prison. And a friend of ours came up and said, "Would you see this?" And he pulled a column out, which was written by Bobby Sands and which had been given to him by some local guy. And he didn't really know where it had came from or who the column was written to. It was like a general column that Bobby sent around the wings, and someone had managed to sort of keep that. And it always reminds me of an occasion when we were in H6 at the time, during the hunger strike, after Bobby had died, and a column came in from the leadership on the outside, and I read the column to the wing that I was in, and then at Mass on Sunday I was given the column to Larry Marley and asked him to read it out to the guys in his wing, and I told him, "Whenever you finish with that, destroy it." And he said to me, "Are you mad?" He says, "That's our history." Mm-hmm. "That's our history." I said, "Well, what are you going to do?" He says, "I save them and then I send them out, and that's all. That's to record the story of the H-Blocks."
So the columns not only helped during that period of time communication from the outside leadership to the inside leadership, but they continue to play a part in recording that historical period in our history.
Well, by their very nature.
By
their very nature, they do that. I mean, I don't think the Republican prisoners were sitting down writing columns saying, "This is going to be the historical record." All they were doing was relating the conditions of their lives that existed and the conditions that existed in the jails. And they were telling us about their worries and their worries about the politics of the time or what they thought of it. There's so many, many dimensions to it.
Well, Luke, I'd like to thank you both for speaking about this period in our history and bringing your own personal experience to the conversation almost 45 years ago now. And I think, without a doubt, you can see the importance of the communication system that was put in place both on the inside and on the outside, and at the contribution that it's continuing to make in terms of the history of that period, particularly for people, young people, interested in that historic period in our struggle for freedom and independence. And that does it for another week. We'd love for you to join the conversation by sharing the link to today's programme to help us grow our audience across our social media platforms. I'd once again like to thank our special guests, Tom Hartley and Shana Walsh. In the meantime, the conversation will be back next week with more investigations and analysis. I'm Jim Gibney. Slán an Uisce. Bye for now.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents. For humanity,
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. This is Hussein Latifi and you're listening to your program For Humanity from IRIB English Radio. In this program we talk about the concept of humanity in the verses of the Holy Quran and the hadith that we have from the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam interpreting and explaining the verses of the Holy Quran about mankind or about different aspects of the human soul. In the previous episodes, we talked about human reason and different verses of the Holy Quran showing the significant role of reason in the perfection of man, and also the ahadith from the Prophet ﷺ talking about the role of reason and intellect in the perfection of a human being. Now, another thing that is left in the tradition that we have in Islamic hadith and the verses of the Holy Quran is the relationship between reason and money and wealth. Which one is better? Now, there is this classic question, wealth or education, which one is better? Wealth or science, wealth or knowledge? And some people give another classic answer is that, well, education and knowledge are better than wealth. And when you ask them why, they say, because, well, you can use science in order to produce wealth. Then at the end of the day, it shows that science is only good as much as it can serve the wealth and money, as much as it can produce money. So you should have said that wealth is better because it's the only goal that some people have in order to gain knowledge. While it is not the case, when we go to the verses of the Holy Quran and the teachings of the Prophet we have not been created to just claim and create piles of money for ourselves. And we take in that way, we take everything else in that service, including our knowledge, including our intellect. Human spirit has different aspects, and all these potentials should be actualized in their own proper position. You should not sacrifice your intellect for desire, and you should not sacrifice the desire for the intellect. Both of them, they have their function. And also about dunya and akhira, وَلَا تَنْسَ نَصِيبَكَ مِنَ الدُّنْيَا. Quran says you should not forget your share from dunya. It's true that wealth is there, money is there, the importance that it has, but it doesn't mean everything else should be measured according to the money that they create. For example, a person, like, he follows a certain career and he likes that career and she likes that career. And then other people blaming him or her because it's not as much well paid, for example, that job. No, it's not. It's about self-realization. It's about how much people see themselves happy in the things that they do. And if we follow the perfection, the plan that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has for us in the Holy Quran and the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt and the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, we realize that if we carry that out, we arrive at a point that we feel completely satisfied. Even if in terms of the financial things, no, it's not like a tycoon having so much money. No, we have decent life. At the end of the day, we also did something that we are happy with ourselves. Many people, rich people, when they arrive at the end of their lives, yes, they have a lot of money, but it's not necessarily true for them to say they're happy about how they spend their life. You see, it happens also. So this feeling should be there, that you realize your potentials in the way that is best for your soul. We're going to have a break and we come back to continue our discussion about the relationship between greed and reason according to the verses of the Holy Quran.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. This is Hossein Latifi, and you're listening to your program for Humanity from IRIB English Radio. In this program and in the first episode, we talked about that classic question about wealth and reason, or wealth and education. And we said sometimes the answers given to this question are not very deep. And sometimes when you investigate, you realize that at the end of the day, money is the ultimate measurement for people to judge the success of a person, which is not correct. Now, we have a hadith in contrast. Imam Ali Amir al-Mu'min alayhi salam qala li ibn al-Hasan, when he advised his son Imam al-Hasan, he said, Ya bunay, O my son, inna aghna al-ghina al-aql. The utmost level of wealth, the most valuable form of wealth, is al-aql, is to have perfect intellect. Wa akbar al-faqr al-humq, and the greatest form, the most severe form of poverty, is when a person is poor in terms of his intellect. And several times we have said it does not talking about like mentally challenged people. It talks about that intellect in the Holy Quran, the intellect that can lead a person towards perfection. So Imam says the best wealth, the best asset a person has, is his intellect. And the worst kind of poverty is when a person does not use such intellect. In another hadith from Imam al-Qadim alayhi salam, Ya Hisham, man arad al-ghina bin amal. If a person wants to be wealthy without money, وَرَاحَةَ al-qalb min al-hasad. If a person wants his heart to be relieved from hasad, jealousy. You know, hasad, jealousy, or envy is something that actually is the most painful for the person himself. Is a kind of challenge that actually eats up the whole heart and other emotions of a person. So if a person is looking for relief of his heart from hasad, jealousy, wassalamata fi ddeen, and also he wants to have a decent, correct, accurate religion, فَلْيَتَذَرَّ إِلَى اللَّهِ عَزَّ وَجَلْ فِي مَسْأَلَتِهِ. He should, such a person, should ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala with humbleness. Tadarru means when you ask and you make a case of request with humbleness toward Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, بِأَنْ يُكْمِلَ عَقْلَهِ. Asking Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, Allah, perfect my intellect. If you perfect my intellect, I will have all these benefits. I will have a salama fi ddeen. I will have an accurate religion. I will have a heart that is at relief. And I will have a wealth without money, effortless wealth. فَمَنْ عَقِلَ قَنَعَ بِمَا يَكْفِي. If a person has intellect, he will be content with a decent life. And if a person does not have intellect, he will never be happy with anything. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to help us perfect and higher and increase our intellect to higher levels. Thank you very much for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
اللهم صل وسلم على الرسول وآل النبي العظيم اللهم صل وسلم على الرسول وآل النبي العظيم اللهم صل وسلم على الرسول وآل النبي العظيم اللهم صل وسلم على الرسول وآل النبي العظيم.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.